So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is November 19th, 2014. And I'd like to talk tonight about the peaceful heart. And you may have noticed that during the meditation, I was encouraging an openness to a growing tranquility of mind and body and heart. And so what does it mean to have a peaceful heart? And that's where I want to explore the intersection of love and peace. Peaceful heart. And as we head into the holidays, and probably true at any time of the year, it's easy to be aware of a sense of disturbance or deficit in the heart. And that's not a heart at peace. So what can we do to fill the heart up, particularly at a time when it can feel emptied out, like we're running on fumes? And also, how can we steady the heart at times when it feels so disturbed, so rattled? So I want to offer five suggestions, and I have a bonus, sixth, and see what you think about it, okay? Okay, great. So the first suggestion is to love peace. In other words, it's really easy to forget peace as a value. Appreciate it. Make it important. How often do we make peace a priority? I don't mean numbing or apathy or suppression. I mean peace, like the peace of a mountain pond or the peace that we feel when we just kind of plop down at the end of a day, go, huh, you know, that kind of peace. How often do we value that? Or that really, really profound peace. I think in the New Testament it's described as that peace which passeth understanding. Or as the Buddha put it, you know, the end of suffering is that highest happiness which is peace. So loving peace, making peace important, you know, encouraging it, opening to it, exploring it, becoming skillful at peace, right? Including peace with other people. And the Buddha also said, there are those who realize that one day they will die, and those who do settle their quarrels. Yeah. So that's my first suggestion. Love peace. What's that like, to love peace? Okay. And obviously in loving peace, mwahaha, built into that is love itself, which feels peaceful and tends to pacify the heart. Secret benefit. The second suggestion I have is there's suffering too. Recognizing the suffering of others tends to calm us down. Have you ever noticed that? You know, that you may be wronged, you may feel wronged. And it's interesting that it helps you feel better to recognize how they're suffering too. It doesn't mean making your suffering less, it doesn't mean approving of them, just they're suffering too. They're running around, they're driving fast, they're under pressure, their feet hurt, they're worried about their kids, somebody just dumped them. They're suffering too, right? The wrong person just got elected in the way they think about things, you know? They're suffering too. You ever play around with that? Like, one thing that's really quite powerful is to see suffering in the faces of other people. Not at all in any superior way, because as soon as you see the suffering in the faces of other people, you see your own face. You know, even privileged faces, faces that are of people who've had good, rich lives with a lot of happiness and haven't been exposed to some of the intense suffering in the world. But even there, you can see the suffering too. The mask slips, you see the little muscles moving around the eyes, around the mouth. You see the suffering too. And notice what happens when we see their suffering. In a funny kind of way, we want to help. We're moved to help, and there can be a certain disturbance, if you will, there. But on the whole, it's calming. They're suffering too, especially the people that, you know, we don't feel at peace with. They're suffering too. Right? Another suggestion, my third one, is that it's not about you. So think of these as kind of flags. Love, peace, just these are suggestions, like a pre-flight for life checklist. But anyway, love, peace, they're suffering too. And third, it's not about you. What do I mean by that? I'm going to give a couple examples. One example was that just before I was about to give a talk, this was about 6 or so years ago, that was the beginning, was a major part of the beginning of my own kind of path over the last 7 or so years. And there were 800 or 900 people in the audience, mostly therapists, and I was following Marsha Linehan and Steve Hayes, who, if you know in the world of psychotherapy, are like legendary, Hall of Fame, exactly, oh, people. And there's little Ricky sitting in the back row with his blue shirt and blazer, freaking out. Oh my God, playing with the big kids now. What am I gonna do, you know? And so there I was, obsessing, ruminating, self-referencing, you know, and imagining what I would say. And then I was like in the simulator, gee, I could say this, but how would that look? And well, I mean, I could say that. And whoa, that would look better. Yeah, let's say that. Lots of suffering there. And so somehow I found myself reading this funky little newsletter that had a quotation in it from the Dalai Lama. And I don't remember what he said. I'm sorry. I'm sure it was, as usual, great. But in that moment, I read this thing, and something really shifted for me. I realized there I was really obsessing about getting them to like me, to approve of me, to think well of me, and so that I would be happy. And my effort to get them to think well of me was making me very unhappy. Right? And I suddenly realized that the most selfish, the most self-referencing, the best, the kindest thing I could do for me, especially for little Ricky, was to stop worrying about what they thought of me and to focus on being of service to them. Completely switched it for me. When I realized that it wasn't about me and how I looked, it was about delivering the goods, delivering the value I could, the best I could do to them, I suddenly relaxed, and of course I realized the best odd strategy for getting them to approve of me was to quit worrying about me and to deliver the goods to them. See, in that kind of reversal way? In that sense, it wasn't about me. And when it became not about me, it became a lot better for me. If you follow that. Okay. A different example is given in this parable from Taoism. You may have heard it. I'm going to update it. The parable goes this way. There you are with a friend. Let's say you're in a canoe in a river and you're just hanging out. You're having a Sunday picnic. Life is really good. And suddenly, boom, there's a thump on the side of your canoe, which tips over, dumps you in the river. There you are. It's cold. It's wet. You're miserable. You come up. What do you see? A couple of teenagers with snorkels and masks, fins, have tipped over your canoe and they're laughing at you. How do you feel? That's take one. Take two of the parable is everything's the same. You're in the canoe with your friend, nice clothes, Sunday picnic, gentle current, and there's a loud thump on the side of your canoe. It tips over. You dropped in the water. You come up again. What do you see? This time you see a big log drifting downstream. It's thumped into you. Everything's the same, but how do you feel? You probably feel a lot different because you're not attributing to the other, to the causes, some kind of personal attack. You're not taking it personally. It's not about you. And the truth is, most of what bumps into us in life, including other people, are just like the logs. Set in motion, teenagers, hormones, they're having a bad day, you know, life, other people. It's not about us. And this way of understanding it doesn't mean not being on our own side. It just means realizing, you know, what's happening here, it's the result of 10,000 causes upstream. They're just not about me. I got to deal with it. I got to dry off my clothes. Maybe next time I'll be on the lookout for logs. Maybe I won't go into that river anymore. Okay? But on the whole, it's just not about me. It's not about you. It's not about you. See? And part of that is to see the complexity of the motives in other people. Why are they doing that? Why are they so rude? Why are they mean? Why are they not helping? Why are they you know, not keeping their agreements. I'm not letting them off the hook. I'm just saying, wow, they're doing what they're doing for dozens, thousands of causes, the way their parents were, the way their parents' parents were, their gender, their social class, modern 21st century economy, you name it. It's not about you. Okay? That's my third suggestion. My fourth suggestion is to, I call it, give over to good. And what I mean by that is that, to use the Buddhist term, the bliss of blamelessness. So it's a situation where there is good in us. We do the best we can. You know, I'm doing this program these days, the Foundations of Well-Being. I'm just doing the best I can. The content demands on me are amazing. 48 talks, 48 practices, reviewing 24 art therapy projects, doing a couple dozen interviews. It's a trip. 48 little self-assessment quizzes. What was I thinking? As we said in the psychedelic days, you ate it, you ride it. So I'm riding this sucker because I've eaten it. But what can you do? You just do the best you can. You work the hours you feel you can until you can sustain the path, you know, with these other people. You do the best you can with them. You give over to the good in your own heart. You know, you try, don't be evil, as they say at Google. We give over to good. We let the good carry us along. You know, more and more that feels like how to be in life, not so much a kind of scratching and clawing our way up the mountaintop, but rather a kind of giving over to the good wind at our back. You know, give over to good. Do the best you can. You know, sometimes that means just bringing your attention back again and again to actually sustaining presence with this other person. Sometimes it means knowing that in a certain situation, you held up your end of the log. Maybe it takes two to carry the log, but at least you know in your heart you held up your own end of that log. It's poignant, it's sad that the log didn't get carried, but you know in your heart you held up your own end of the log. You know, you lived by your own code, you practiced unilateral virtue, you gave over to good. Okay? And then the last suggestion I have, and I'm deliberately creating time in here to talk about this. What does it take to have a peaceful heart? Actually, it's my fifth suggestion before my bonus. My fifth suggestion is to let go. Isn't that so true? We're, you know, there's a saying in AA, resentment is taking poison and waiting for others to die. You know, I saw someone earlier today who just loves to come in to see me. And every 2 weeks, the first 35 minutes are this very thorough account of all his basis for resentment. You know, and I'll try to derail it, and I've just come to see, you know, like there's some involvement there, some gratification with resentment, right? Not letting go. Ajahn Chah, the teacher of Jack Kornfield and a number of other people in the kind of Buddhist stream I mainly stand in, Southeast Asian Thai teacher, said if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. We could say as well, I'm going to paraphrase Ajahn Chah, he's not alive, so I can maybe get away with this. But anyway, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace, right? Peaceful heart. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll be completely peaceful. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, isn't it? Where, you know, we know that point where we're holding on to our grievances, like carrying hot coals around in our bare hands, throwing them at others, burning us too. We know that feeling where it's time to let go of our view, our position, our righteousness. Often there's that thing where we just let go in this moment. It's very interesting that as we let go in this moment as well, and this one too, and this one, we become more peaceful. The heart feels somehow more peaceful when we're not trying to hold on, where we recognize transience. Fundamental insight of the Buddha is the profound power of the all-pervading recognition of transience, passing. That the nature of phenomenology of our experience is that it's passing, continually passing. And if you really, really see deeply into that, as he puts it, to paraphrase some things he would say, something like, you know, being nice to other people is worth, I'm paraphrasing, 10 elephants made of gold, okay? Being nice to someone who's a sincere spiritual practitioner is worth, you know, 1,000 elephants of gold. One moment of insight into impermanence is worth 1,000,000 elephants made of gold. That's very close to what he said, essentially. All right? So insight into impermanence and letting go. Have you ever noticed that? Kind of what it feels like to let go in your body? Letting go brings a peaceful heart. Okay, so far? And here's my bonus. You know, I don't know if you were here 2 weeks ago when I did this little talk on three kinds of meditation, the last one being let go and be Buddha. You know, that's a mode of meditating. And that's very interesting to listen to that talk, especially I think the latter part of it. It's posted to my website where this talk as well is posted. And I should add that if you want to be on the mailing list for the sitting group, there's a little sign-up sheet over there. So my bonus, number 6, peaceful heart. The way I would put it is, be the whole. And what I mean by that, it's very interesting. Like, most of the time when we're just kind of being in our mind, what really is going on, if you look at it, is parts interacting with parts, right? There's the donut. Ah, donut. That's a part of the field of awareness. Wanting the donut, that's a second part. No, no, Ricky, don't want the donut. That's a third part. Then there might be a fourth or fifth part. You see that so much that's going on? That's often how mind unfolds. Yet if you look at it, actually, all those parts are just aspects of the whole, of mind as a whole, including its awareness aspect, and available to us without getting super mystical or cosmic or anything. Even when we come down from what we've been writing, we recognize that mind is a whole, and we can be the whole. And when we be the whole of just mind, just aware, what, you know, phenomenology, just be experience, just be the whole of experience. Weirdly, the heart calms down. We settle. We feel more peaceful, right? Because inside the whole of experience is often agitation, right? We're disturbed by something. We're hurt, we're irritated, we're worried, we feel pressured. We have to do, you know, we have to carry 5 quarts in a 1 gallon bucket, right, all day long. I'm keeping that extra quart in the air as we cross the bridge, is not so easy. There's disturbance, but mind as a whole, the whole of awareness, the whole of our experience is itself never disturbed. It's always just what it is. It's always a whole. See, that makes sense? There's disturbance in it, but the whole is not disturbed. It's like you could say the surface of the ocean is often disturbed. There's movement in the, there's an even underwater movement in the ocean, but ocean as ocean, all the salt water circling our globe itself is never changed. It's just ocean. Right? Same way, mind as mind is always just mind. It's not disturbed. And when you kind of be the whole, as soon as you start thinking about it, you're a part of the whole commenting on another part, you know, the concept of the whole. But if you just be the whole, that really pacifies the heart. It tranquilizes the heart. It creates a peaceful heart. And to take it a step further, be the whole, where you realize, wow, this mind moment, this mind experience, the mind in this moment, arises dependently upon material reality, nature, cosmos, sunlight, oxygen. We're breathing the exhalations of trees, mainly, and grass and other green things, right? Wow. So there's a sense of be the whole. Immediately you calm down. And then if you have an intuition of it or if it's meaningful for you, you know, being, see, in other words, material reality, allness altogether never changes. There's change in it. But allness altogether is never disturbed as allness. You know, I don't mean to get intellectual about it, you can kind of recognize that that's true. Like, holy moly, wow, that's very calming, very peaceful inducing. A lot of entangled ruckuses with other people just stop being so important when you go, whoa, reality altogether, whoa. And then if you have an intuition of anything transcendental or divine or some mystery perhaps, and be that, that itself doesn't change either, right? It's never disturbed as mystery. That's very calming. So that's a bonus, you know, if you connect with that bonus. But anyway, that's kind of it. Hope that was helpful. I don't know if you received my generosity, whatever, but, you know, love, peace. They're suffering too. It's not about you. Give over to good. Let go. And be the whole. It's a nice way to move into having a peaceful heart, including at this time of year. So, it's my offering. What do you make of it? Any nightmare scenarios? In-laws, you know? Wayward children? Particular situations? And, you know, yeah.
Something. So I haven't come here before. Oh, thank
good.
You so much. It was really a great evening. Oh. I put you in my calendar a few weeks ago, and then as the day wore on today, you know, I had, oh, come to dinner. Another, well, let's go see a movie. And it was very tempting. You know, it's rainy, it's cold, I've never been here, you know.
Yeah.
But I put you in my calendar, and I said, okay, I'm going to come. And I've been feeling very, you know, I hurt someone really badly, completely unintentionally. I feel sick about it, and there's nothing I can do to make it right, which is so unusual that you can't make it right.
Yeah.
And just to hear that your topic was about, you know, heart, and what was it, the answer for?
Peaceful heart.
Peaceful heart is, like, so perfect. So it's like, it's just like the universe is amazing that, like, I just had so many other opportunities, but I made myself come. You know, it's exactly what I needed to hear. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And yeah. And isn't it interesting, like just in this moment, in your offering of that, you're probably something calming and tranquilizing is happening for you. And definitely in my receiving of you right now, you know, again, something calming, peacefulizing.
Yeah, it's really beautiful being here tonight, so thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, please.
Yeah, so I'm glad you said that. I kind of hurt somebody really inadvertently, and they just took it the wrong way.
Yeah.
And so you talked about resentment, so I was thinking, well, I can let go of her resentment of me. So it's kind of like not resentment, but yeah, so.
Oh, I see. Okay, you can let go related to the she's resentful. And I was thinking in both cases, in a funny way too, it's not about me. I mean, yeah, I was the person who stepped on their foot in some sense. But that happened as part of a larger whole, right? The trick is, of course, not to use that as a kind of spiritual bypass, as John Willwood puts it, you know, to justify all kinds of rude behavior and mistreatment of others or callous indifference to them. But you're right. In a way, it's not about me. And I think what life is so much is about, you know, repair and doing the best we can to repair. And, you know, again, give over to good, the good in your heart, or even all I can do, wow, is just feel bad about this. Have the wince of this land so that I'm gooder the next time, as it were. And that's the best I can do. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So are you saying, you know, it's not about me? Well, oftentimes it's hard not to think that it's about me. Have you ever had your wife or child say something pretty nasty or negative to you, and how do you deal with that in that context?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a great question. So let's say there you are, and this other person mistreats you, especially someone that you've loved a lot, and especially someone that's really important to you, like a wife, a child, okay? It's real, and it's not making it up. They really did do it, all right? I think that, you know, I could have said more, but in the peaceful heart part, you know, I think obviously part of it is to be kind and loving toward yourself. And to have that kind of friendliness, which starts often with, ooh, ow, that hurts. And it's sort of like if we see a young child, let's say, who falls down, and, you know, their knee is bloody, and, you know, you can tell, wow, that really hurts, and, you know, we want to go, oh, we're soothing toward that other person, right? It's natural. Well, can we be soothing in that way to ourselves? So I think that's a very important part of it. And a lot of research shows that self-compassion makes us more resilient, and it actually leads us to become more pro-social toward other people as well. So it's not just appropriately selfish to do it or self-interested, but it's also benevolent to be self-compassionate. So I think that's a very important piece of it. And when I bypass that and in my early Spock-like way just jump to problem solving, it just didn't work that well, and I was left with unresolved pain related to what happened. Yeah. So the self-compassion in its nature, much as compassion for others opens to their pain, self-compassion opens to our pain, which is very protective. It means we're not going to suppress it or, you know, push it away, especially if we're inclined to do that for any reason, such as our gender socialization, you know, or our cultural upbringing, what have you. So that's the first point. You know, that helps calm the heart too. I think I'll add it as number 7, self-compassion. The other thing I find is that, you know, I say what I can, and then I try to move on, you know. Obviously there are many situations where we can't say anything, or it would be pouring gasoline on the fire to say anything. But at some point, you know, I look to see what can I say, because I feel incomplete till I communicate for myself. And it's a great question. Are you communicating for yourself, or are you communicating to change the other person, including to, you know, change them so they'll admit their own fault? And I think there's a place for being, you know, skillfully persuasive, or trying to help them understand, you know, you can't do that, or if you ever do that again, or X or Y or Z. But what's our way of communicating? We often, I think, get caught up in trying to get something to happen in the black box of the mind over there. And that's way out of our control. And if it doesn't go the way we want, we feel really dissatisfied. And the alternative is to really communicate for ourselves so that we know that we've said what there is to say, and we feel like we've gotten it off our chest in a skillful way, and we're on record, and we discover our own truth in part by speaking it. And that's a very different way to communicate. And I think of this quote of the Buddha that someone put on a cup they gave me a little while ago. You know, he says, someone is not wise who says the right stuff. Someone is truly wise who is peaceable, friendly, and fearless. There's a kind of fearlessness in communicating for ourselves, right? So I think about that too, you know. And then I kind of just move on a lot myself. And I you know, I'm going to quote, believe it or not, President Ronald Reagan here, trust but verify. In other words, I'm really interested, trust but verify. You know, I'm really interested in what they're going to do. And speaking for myself, I'm going to watch. And I'm going to see, like, do they take my wants seriously? Are they willing to admit their own piece of the puzzle? Right? And based on what they do, you know, I'm willing to take action myself, and I know that. I don't want to be trapped. You know, the Buddha a lot, it's an interesting word that I've found myself reflecting on more and more. He talked about the importance of disentangling. Part of that is to disentangle the threads of the tapestry of experience, of phenomenology, you know. So we see it's more and more in compounded nature, so that any little bit of it is empty of absolute self-arising in the technical sense of empty. That's very powerful. We do that. It's very central to our practice. But also we kind of disentangle ourselves from contentiousness with other people. A lot I do is I try to disentangle myself from the scripts that other people are trying to write me into, you know? And Yeah. So, okay. Other situations or comments? Yeah, please.
When you were talking about how everything is transient, when I sit here on Wednesday nights, this makes perfect sense. This is so bad. I'm just convinced I've been transformed. By Friday at 2 p.m., it's all gone, the downhill spiral. This becomes transient.
Yeah.
And it has to, why don't we remember it? Why
yeah.
can't this stay from Wednesday to Wednesday?
That's right. That's right. Oh, well, thank you for saying that. It's really true. You know, we have it shows up in lots of different ways, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you're in a situation with someone and you're talking to them, it goes badly, you're arguing with them, you have this white light moment. Don't, say that word or don't lose my temper in that way. You really, really believe it. And then it happens again. Yeah, well, that's another example of that. So the thing to do is to work on pushing it out to Friday at 3 p.m. In other words, I've asked myself the same question, and I think there are different answers to it. And one answer is, we're not designed to recognize impermanence. Because the nature of cognizing, the nature of thought, of mental activity, is to essentialize, turn into things, to thingize, to thingify stuff that is part of a much larger network. We try to essentialize, and we also have to stabilize things that are passing. Otherwise, we can't. If the monkey, let's say, who saw this yellow shape, went, wow, so transient, endlessly, kind of quivering around its edges, the monkey would never reach for the banana. We have to cognize. We have to centralize. We have to stabilize. So you see this, actually, that's kind of a deep source of a kind of suffering or tension. In other words, the requirements of biological survival to create boundaries in a world that's intertwined, right? To stabilize in a world that's always changing, and to, just those two things right there. I'll just leave it right there. That's at odds with the nature of reality. So I think that's one part. It's hard to recognize impermanence in that way, and especially to let it go. We understand it conceptually. Things always change, right? Except change itself, but to really feel it. What you can do, though, more and more, is when you start having a sense of these things, especially, this is a spiritual path. People can relate to this path in fairly baseline or foundational ways, like, pay attention and be nice. Like, what's wrong with that? That's pretty good. But to go further and further, we start having intimations of something profound. There's an opening. We start going, whoa, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is something. And people start looking at us a little differently, like, whoa, something's going on there. Something starts to change. The question is, are we brave enough to let ourselves change, including allowing subtleties to land in us, recognitions, openings, releases, letting goes, right? Can we let those land and stabilize, and literally in terms of neuroplasticity, become more stable in our own brain? So there's more and more of a relaxed recognition of just passing, 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 arising, arising, passing, arising, passing. You know? That's the kind of learning. It's the way I look at it, it's like learning. Learning, awakening. As a path, as a process, not an either or, on or off kind of thing. Great, all good, good. Maybe one more person, then we'll finish by a little sitting.
Something I thought was really helpful what you were talking about this evening, I was thinking about situations where maybe someone's upset with me and they feel like it's all about me. So I'm kind of looking at it from the perspective of it's not about me, or maybe more accurately, it's not all about me. I think that an area where these techniques would really help me is being able to not react quite so much in those kind of scenarios where I think being calm, I'll be able to see things more clearly and really see the role that I do play and be able to address that rather than either going to a defensive place or a hurt place and just being very emotional and reactionary, but having the calm to just see things as they are more clearly.
Thank you for saying that. You're really emphasizing, you know, being calmer. You know, if the engine is running, you know, if it idles at 1,000 RPMs, you know, and suddenly it's now 4,000, any little thing, you're going to crash. So when we get revved up, it's a lot easier to get into trouble, right? And that's, you know, there's a lot about that. So thank you for saying that. And, as a little part of that, the idea of slowing it down, like when I'm a couples counselor and I'll see couples, you know, and they're having, you can just tell what's happening. It's like a nuclear reaction. It's a runaway, you know. Bing, bang, bing, bang, bing, bang, bing, bang. You know, like, whoa, let's just stop at bing. Let's feel our end of bing. What was going on with bing, you know? But no, I got you, you want to go bang, but let's just hang out with bing a little longer here, right? I'm like the graphite rods in a nuclear reactor soaking up stray neutrons, you know? Right? Exactly what you're saying. That's really sweet. And maybe we'll finish, I'll kind of join what you said and what you said a little bit. It's, you know, I think one reason why learning doesn't stick or why it's hard to kind of be like that Jedi Knight, you know, really centered, you know, is it's hard for us. We're really busy. Our minds are running through all kinds of stuff. You know, we're not designed really as animals to just hang in like white light all day long, right? We're just not designed. And so my point about that is to have compassion for ourselves. Also, we're busy. We think about other things. The next thing you know, and my wife and I have suddenly discovered a new TV show, Parenthood. So these plot lines are going through my mind as I fall asleep and wake up. And, you know, it's kind of like we're like this. And so what I'm getting at is because we're like this, out of, again, that friendliness to ourselves, kindness to ourselves, we realize, aha, causes and conditions. That's the essence, again, of Buddha Dharma, appreciating causes and conditions. Things arise due to causes, and whatever arises due to causes will pass away due to causes, right? So what are the causes and conditions of our practice? And then we start realizing, you know, I could help myself by having some kind of regular practice. Committing to, let's say, meditating at least a minute or more a day. Okay? I could also commit to exposing myself to some bit of wisdom every day. Maybe I listen to a little thing, or I get a little four-line quote from the Buddha in my case, or, you know, pop open the Course in Miracles and just read the sentence your eye drops on, you know. Good stuff, whatever it might be. I'm going to commit to an encounter with wisdom. Right? That's a thought. Or maybe there are other little disciplines we do, like yoga, because it calms ourselves down. Or we know that it really works to do that walk with the dog in the morning. And we're going to do a little gratitude practice around that. Go to Taranay's art class thingies. Really good stuff, you know? I know Linda's been doing a beautiful, mindful self-compassion programs. You know, like doing these things, like this side of awakening that's irrevocable, it's going to fade. That's the nature of it. We progress on the path, but it tends to fade, you know? And I think out of kindness to ourselves, we can do these little things to keep it going, including showing up here on Wednesdays or other forms of good company. Really important. Yeah. Last, I imagine that I'm being videotaped in terms of helping myself stay in my green zone, and that the video record is going to be played before, fill in the blank, the Board of Psychology, you know, a judge at our children's wedding, or my memorial service. And think, how do you want to be so that you'd be cool if not even happy about what's being played in that recording, including how rapidly you recover when you lose it and how rapidly you clean it up when you lose it. Got to finish, but yeah.
I just discovered something that's really made a difference for me, and I'm compelled to share it, so thanks for calling me. One of the things I noticed about how our brains are designed is that we're able to recover from really disastrous situations. So I can be in a terrible accident, become crippled, and my brain can kind of go back to the last known good configuration. My dog can die. I can have really, you know, terrible things happen to me, and then somehow I reset to the last known good configuration.
Yeah.
Well, that is actually anti-learning.
Hmm.
Because as I learn something new, it's outside of the comfort zone, and I have this kind of natural reset to last known good configuration.
Uh-huh.
And so I have to keep putting those things kind of in the system on a consistent basis. Otherwise, I kind of reset for this kind of safety, survival body thing that seems to be kind of hardwired. So that's what I find, you know, when Friday it isn't working, and after it was really great on Wednesday. Part of that is I'm just kind of resetting to the last known configuration with a couple nights sleep.
There you are. Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. So I just really invite you to know what it feels like to have a peaceful heart, right? To use the saying, moments of awakening many times a day, right? Moments of peaceful heart many times a day. And then when you have that sense of peaceful heart, even right now, what's it feel like to have a peaceful heart? It can contain disturbance, or it might be underneath disturbance. But there is some place always truly inside us that's still, that has a stillness and a lovingness. Right? It's stable. It's stably loving. Can you find that sense and then sit with it for the next minute or so? Thank you. Take good care.
So my therapist, oh sorry.